You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Jimmy Webb is my guest this week. Jimmy Webb is one of the great songwriters. His songs include MacArthur Park, Up, Up, and Away, By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and Wichita Lineman. He's just published a memoir entitled The Cake and the Rain. Jimmy Webb, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You know, in Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, poor Billy Pilgrim, he's unstuck in time. He keeps swinging back and forth through the events of his life, just like you. Just like you in The Cake and the Rain.
Yeah, I sort of adapted that device early on because one of the things I wanted to avoid, because I've read, I'm nothing if I'm not a reader, and I've read a lot of autobios and a lot of biography, including I've read Joseph Conrad's autobiography, which is a great read if you ever get a chance. But the one flaw I find in a lot of autobiographical stuff is that it's almost always linear, and I think sometimes is where the story kind of gets bogged down. And the contrast and what makes my life, I think, if anything, worthy of review, is that my origins were so humble, and that I literally went from being a farm laborer and, you know, a not very good, you know, C-minus student, not a great athlete, not popular with the kids, nothing. The only thing I had was this somewhat pathetic and a hopeless dream that maybe I could turn my skills at the piano and my love of poetry into some sort of career. And that's all I had. It wasn't fleshed out. It was just that vague. And I knew that I loved Glen Campbell. I knew that I wanted to write Glen Campbell songs. And I had some innate ability that the good Lord had given me, which was a pretty good ear, and the ability to play almost anything once I heard it. But what I do in the book is I constantly contrast this, the barren, almost ghostly quality of West Texas, of these sandstorms and these little churches that I literally can't even remember the names of them, where my father used to pastor, and then suddenly cut to 1969 and the house that Phil Harris built for Flower Stay, which I bought, and I'm living in, you know, relative splendor and driving the Cobra around that I bought from Carol Shelby, and it's like, is this the same guy? You know, because it was such an impossible thing for me to, and I'm not going to say for me to accomplish, because I don't believe that I did accomplish it. I believe it was a very fatalistic thing. It was sort of written in the stars, obviously, that Glenn and I would get together, and Glenn used to say preparation meets opportunity. Well, I was prepared. When I got to Hollywood, I had 50 songs, and I was grimly determined I was gonna get some kind of record made.
Well, did you when you heard the songs in your head, did you think, oh, this could be a Glenn Campbell song, or did you just write the songs and then try to fit them in?
No, I heard early Glen Campbell records. I heard Turn Around, Look at Me on Crest Records when I was 14 years old. And it practically knocked me off my tractor. I was out in the middle of, you know, 3,000 acres of wheat land plowing wheat stubble under so that they could plant another crop. And right out there in the middle of the, you know, wheat fields in the panhandle of Oklahoma, where you could easily see 10 or 20 miles, and it was flat, flat as the top of your kitchen range. And here is this gorgeous voice, is, you know, just this edge of plaintive, you know, insecurity, but still the most beautiful texture and intonation and pie. I mean, he just bowled me over, and I said, I want to write songs for this guy. And I actually prayed. I actually went home and prayed. I said, dear God, you know, let me, you know, let me, if you know, if you can, and if you got time to deal with my problems, because I know you're real busy, but could I meet Glenn Campbell, and do you think he might be able to record one of my songs? And that was my prayer. That was my little prayer, 14 years old. And from then on, I wrote Glenn Campbell songs. Whenever I got a chance, I would write a song and say, this would be good for Glenn. And in fact, one I wrote in Colton, California, when my father moved us there and I was 16, I was working in the Three Bear coffee shop in Rubidoux, California, which was kind of one suburb over. And my father and the family had already deserted California and gone back to Oklahoma after my mother's death, which was a particularly tragic thing. And I was working in this coffee shop as a busboy and washing dishes in the back, and wrote a song called Honey Come Back. And 10 years later, it was a number one record for Glenn, number one country and western records. I was always writing songs for Glenn, long before I met him.
When you finally did make those wonderful records, by the time I get to Phoenix, was Phoenix the first one? I think you had already, Johnny Rivers had already recorded that song, yes?
Johnny Rivers recorded that song. Something that I like to put forward, if I can, is that Johnny Rivers was a quintessential part of my experience in California, because he signed me as a writer, he gave me a group to work with, the Fifth Dimension, and he called Al DeLore after he had recorded By the Time I Get to Phoenix on an album called Changes, and one of the big hits on that album was Poor Side of Town.
What a great song that is.
And I love that song. I just loved it. And I thought, this is going to be great. I'm going to be on the album. Well, Poor Side of Town went to number one. And Glenn called Al DeLore and said, I have a song over here that's a hit for Glenn. And I don't know whether Al mentioned it to Glenn or not, but Al came over to Johnny's place. And Johnny had a test pressing of Changes, and Al heard By the Time I Get to Phoenix. This actually happened. Johnny played the record for him, and he heard By the Time I Get to Phoenix, and he said to Johnny, I don't get it. He said, this is a hit song. He says, why are you giving us this song? And Johnny said back to him, listen, Al, you can only have one number one record at a time. And he was actually doing it for me, because I was his writer, and he believed in me. And as soon as Glenn heard it, Glenn ran with it. He was on the air with it in, I don't want to say days, but certainly in a very few weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, he was on the air with By the Time I Get to Phoenix. The story goes, it was a very, very funny story, that he was making a record with Merle Haggard, and Merle Haggard was putting out his single, and Glenn said, you know, Merle, I got an idea. He says, when you send out your single, he says, could I put By the Time I Get to Phoenix in there? And so Merle, being a good old, you know, easygoing Oklahoma boy, and actually Toby Keith tells this story. He loves it. And I think it's true. So Merle Haggard sent out By the Time I Get to Phoenix with his single, which was, you know, Fannie Mae or whatever it was. And Merle's record didn't do anything, but Glenn's was a hit. So somebody was talking to Merle about it, and they said, is it true that you sent Glenn Campbell's single out with your record? And Merle says, yeah. And he says, next time you can tell him, he can send out his own record, you know.
The sound of Glenn Campbell's record, by the time I get to Phoenix, it's got a beautiful plaintive arrangement. Did you have anything to do with the record itself?
Not a lot. Al DeLore was really, you know, that was his control room. He had a very distinctive minimalist string writing style, which I think, in retrospect, was a really good thing, because if I had been arranging those things, they would have been much more florid. They probably would have had woodwinds. There would have been woodwinds or French horns involved, and he was a good producer. He knew that Glenn should be not too far from pure country, but of course now country music has never really claimed Glenn as a country artist. They certainly have. I haven't been. I'm a member of the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, but CMA has never honored me as being a country songwriter or anything like that. Actually, I was part of something they call Poets and Prophets at the museum a few weeks ago, and I was very grateful that I got to come in, and they sort of made a day for me, and I played my songs. But clearly, I'm not a pure country writer. I was always involved in jazz. I was involved in, to a greater degree than most people know, in rock and roll. A lot of my records, my personal records, were rock and roll records, and I loved rock and roll. And Glenn's records have a historical importance, because they were the first country crossover records. They came out of the country milieu, but they were pop records, and they scaled the pop charts. And all of a sudden, people realized, hey, you know, there had been Roger Miller with Dang Me and King of the Road and things like that. Those records, frankly, they were kind of novelty records. Yeah, they were treated as novelty records. So Glenn created the roadbed for Kenny Rogers and Lionel Richie and a lot of people.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before. By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working.
So I think that, you know, I would look back on that with a great deal of pride, that at least, you know, I had a little bit of something to do with it. But the arranging, you know, that was the Wrecking Crew. Glenn always used the Wrecking Crew. Carol Kay on bass, always. I used Joe Osborne. I used basically the same band, but I had nothing against Carol, but I just used Joe Osborne. The first album that I ever really arranged for Glenn was the reunion album that we did with Jimmy Bolin at Harold Shedd's studio in Nashville. And a lot of people say that's the best record that Glenn ever made, but I don't know whether I'm one of those people or not. It was a good record.
A very good record. Well, you know, it is interesting to think about the how much an arrangement has to do with a song. One of the songs that I love of yours is that song, Crying in My Sleep, which you do a lovely version of on one of your albums.
Thank you.
There's also Art Garfunkel's beautiful recording of that song.
It's again, there's another voice, you know, to be contended with. You know, I mean, when I became a singer-songwriter, unquote, I was competing with my customers, and my customers were the best singers in the business.
I took a walk around the yard. I dug the flowers till it got too hard. I smoked my first pack of cigarettes today while I watched the dogs playing. Then I went down to Lucy's old cafe. I put a half a case away. I took a sleeping pill. I tried to watch TV. But you know, baby, the leading lady looked too much like you for the likes of me. And I woke up crying in my sleep. I was talking to your pillow. And I reached out to touch your I said, no thanks, baby, tonight there ain't no help for me. See, I just had a bad dream. That's all that's wrong with me. See, I just had a bad dream. Went out to loosen up the car. Somehow I wound up at the Rainbow Bar. I had a scotch and soda on the run, but I didn't get too far. Then I ran down some friends I used to know. I dragged them out to see the show. I ran myself a bath and I tried to read your book. But you know, baby, this time it just didn't seem worth all.
You know, so I think people, you know, might have been rightfully a little bit disappointed in my sound, which is quite homespun and a little, you know, a little bit thinner. You know, I'm proud of some of my singing. I'm very proud of. You know, I have good pitch, I have good phrasing. A lot of songwriters copy my phrasing over the years. But in terms of just being gifted with a golden instrument, I mean, you got to go some to beat Glenn. And Mr. Sinatra, Linda Ronstadt, who I worked with a lot, hardly anybody could top her. And then there was, you know, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, they were the Fifth Dimension. Billy Davis sang a lot of my stuff. He was, in my book, another Otis Redding. He was every bit as good as Otis. He was sort of marooned in a group that really didn't do any hard, you know, driving R&B. I think they could have. But, you know, they were doing Age of Aquarius, and they were doing Laura Nero. They were cutting Laura Nero's Stone Soul Picnic and stuff like that. And they were very middle of the road, very poppy R&B. And I kind of got tagged with that. It was like, okay, you know, pop music's Mozart, somebody called me one time. I cringed. I wanted to kill myself, you know. Somebody says, hey, that's a compliment, man. I said, I don't want to be pop music's Mozart, man. I want to be Mick Jagger.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with songwriter Jimmy Webb. His new memoir is called The Cake and the Rain. In addition to being a songwriter, he's also a recording artist and has recorded many solo albums. Your first solo album was in 1970?
Yeah, it actually came out in 71, and it was called Words and Music.
And was that like an attempt to change your image?
Well, it wasn't so much. I was, you know, that was who I was. I mean, my favorite band was the Rolling Stones, and I had a three-piece band. I had a virtuosos all. Fred Tackett, who eventually ended up in Little Feat, a permanent member,
right, after
Lowell George died. And my drummer, Ray Rich, was a hardcore, you know, circuit drummer. He played the Midwest forever. He was like, he came from the kind of Ronnie Dove and the Hawks, that kind of thing. My bass player, Skip Mosier, was a former aerodynamic engineer at Caltech and could arrange as well as I could. He had an absolutely comprehensive knowledge of music. So here's this band, and you would have had to, you know, been there. I mean, if you'd come to see us at the Cellar Door in Washington, D.C., you know, in 1971, or the Bitter End in New York, we were playing rock and roll. You know, there were four of us, and you know, you listen to the albums, and you can imagine those songs being played. My second album, and so on, we got the Stereo Review Award for Album of the Year. I look back on them, and I don't think they're particularly great albums, and I think that the one that stands out is Letters, because I think I was taking some very demanding vocal instruction and really trying to discipline myself and listening to myself. And I think I did my first real singing on Letters when I recorded Galveston. I think that's really worth listening to. And my voice was high, and it was clear, and it was in tune, and it was more controlled, and it was less idiosyncratic. It was less through the side of my nose than some of the stuff that I've been doing. I think that I've continued to improve as a singer. I think I'm a better singer than I ever was.
Or you're going to do some more albums? It wasn't that long ago that you put an album out.
No, I did two albums in Nashville. Both of them charted. You know, it was Adult Contemporary. It was sort of the geezer chart, Linda Ronstadt calls it. But the albums themselves I'm extremely proud of. We did with guest artists like Vince Gill, Billy Joel, Mark Knopfler, Keith Urban, Lucinda Williams.
I love that.
Artie Garfunkel, Brian Wilson. There were two albums. The first one was called Just Across the River, and the second one was called Still Within the Sound of My Voice. And it's just, you know, I can't tell you. I was a little bit pissed off that we didn't get an honorable mention, at least a nomination for the Grammys. But I've been a little bit pissed off at the Grammys for a while, so.
Well, they did honor you right away back in 1966, or what year was it that you won for Up, Up, and Away?
Well, at the outset, in 1967, I won Song of the Year.
Up, Up, and Away faced some pretty stiff competition for the Grammy Award that year.
If you want to talk about that, that's a fascinating turn of events, really, because I was nominated twice for Song of the Year. I was nominated for By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Up, Up, and Away. So I figured I had zero chance of winning the Grammy Award.
You were going to up against yourself?
The records would split my fans, and I was up against two extremely strong records. I'm not sure about the other one. I think there were five. But I know I was up against Gentle on My Mind by John Hartford, and I would claim that song anytime. I mean, that's
another great record of Glenn's.
A masterful song. And also Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry, which really had created a whole zeitgeist with the American public. You know, what did Billy Joe McAllister throw off the Tallahatchie Bridge? With a wonderful, wonderful string arrangement by Jimmy Haskell that just kind of evoked, you know, the Mississippi Delta and these hot, you know, these endless hot days and the suggestion of evil, the suggestion of something going terribly wrong. It was the 3rd of June, another dirty, dusty Delta day. You know, and I mean, she had done a great reading on it. She was a great chick, too. I loved her. But when they finally announced the songs, it was Up and Away that came up winners that year. That was my first Grammy.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together, you and I. For we can.
Up, Up, and Away was suddenly like everywhere when that record came out. That was such a pervasive hit.
It was pervasive in part because it was recorded by so many artists. I mean, there were three identical records. One of them was the Johnny Mann Singers. One of them was ours. They just copied our record. I mean, they copied it note for note.
Yeah.
And we were playing Leapfrog up the charts, the Fifth Dimension and the Johnny Mann Singers. Now the irony of that is that both of those records were on Liberty. I mean, our record company had released a record that sounded like our record. I never understood that, because had Up, Up, and Away been left alone, and then somebody else, some British group, copied it. They had a version out. And if we had just gotten a clean release and been allowed to promote our record to the top of the chart, I think Up, Up, and Away would have been number one. Because we were neck and neck with the Johnny Mann Singers all the way up the charts. They got half our sales. Half the time, people didn't know who they were listening to. They didn't know whether it was them or us. So, again, you know, freaky, you know. I never really had anybody explain it to me how and why that was allowed to take place on the same label.
Jimmy Webb, originally you wrote your song MacArthur Park that became a huge hit for Richard Harris. You intended that song to be recorded by the group The Association, but the group rejected the song.
Well, you know, I don't know whether you remember the recounting in the book, but it was an odd, you know, thing that had happened. I'd been asked to write it by Bones Howe, and I wrote it for them. They took it down to the studio, and I was playing it for them, and I was right in the middle of the most industrious part, like right in the middle. And with a very, very loud rip, the seat of my pants gave way, and it was it was like an elephant fart, okay? it was just horrifying. And everybody sort of broke up. Everybody laughed. And I thought, oh, that's it. They're not going to end up doing this. But the truth is, you know, those guys, I don't have any problem with them. And there was some kind of a rumor at some point that I had some kind of a bitch with them, or Terry or somebody. I honestly never really gave it a second thought. You know, I've been turned down so many times. They wanted to turn it down. That was fine. It was Bones Howe who got hostile with them over it, and he told them if they turned it down, that if it ever hit the top 10, they would be looking for another producer. But I honestly, I loved those guys. They were one of my favorite groups. I actually would go and see them when I was in high school. They would come to San Bernardino. I'd go to see the concert. It's sort of, you know, I mean, I had I felt like I was really moving heaven and earth. You know, I was sort of the Michelangelo of the rock pop world, and I was creating this masterpiece. So there was a little bit of a disappointment. But the truth is, there was a limit to how much sound you could put on a vinyl record, because there were really grooves on there, and they took up it wasn't an infinite amount of space like it is now in this digital world. It was very, very finite, you know, series of grooves that were laid down, and the needle tracked in this groove, and they had guys in Hollywood who cut the masters and made those grooves who were regarded as shamans. I mean, like high priests of rock and roll. They were the guys who actually cut the records. And it was all about getting a loud, poppy sound on your record. If they had put MacArthur Park on that record, that side of their record would have sounded like shit. Those are the sort of physical facts. And I just don't think that they had counted on, maybe I got a little carried away, you know, 7 minutes, 21 seconds. But it immediately went to the bottom of my pile, because that's the way songwriters are. You know, if something gets rejected, I mean, it goes to the bottom. And it was, you know, just a few months later, I was over in England and literally going through my whole portfolio there, and it finally gotten down to the bottom pretty much. And I remember unfolding that thing over Richard Harris's piano, and just singing the first line. I recall the yellow cotton dress foaming like a wave on the ground around your knees. Singing that and having Richard like slap the piano with this great big meaty hand, like as big as a ham, and he goes whop like that, and he says, "I'll have that Jimmy whip. I'll have that, and I'll make a hit out of it. I will, and I'll be a pop star." And he really did say that.
Well, and he did.
And he really did become a pop star.
Did you intend the lyric to be striped pair of pants?
Yeah, I had a striped pair of pants. Everything in there is like real.
Uh-huh. Well, you do a good job in the book of describing the origins of it. Now we let our readers read the book and hear all about it.
Well, people have wondered, you know, obviously, and to tell you the truth, since I've written the book and since it's been out, people have read it, and they've come into my concerts and said, "But what does the cake out in the rain mean?" You know, I can't win that one, you know. I'm going to go to my grave with that, so. But at least I took a shot at it.
Frank Sinatra made a record of MacArthur Park, but he only recorded part of the song.
No, he didn't like most of it. It was too hippie. And he's quoted as saying to somebody that they were trying to cut the whole thing, right?
Yep.
So they're at the beginning. One can only imagine somewhere these tapes must exist, you know, unless. And he was singing, "In love's hot fevered iron, like a striped pair of pants." And he said into the microphone, "This is the stupidest, dumbest f-ing song I ever heard." So he did. He hated the front of it. And he hated the choruses. But right in the middle of MacArthur Park is this sort of little ballad. It could be like, you know, it could be Jimmy Van Heusen I don't know, Harold Arlen or something like that. And it's just "After All the Loves of My Life," and it's really totally self, you know, freestanding, self-supporting little, you know, ballad, almost like a 40s ballad that's just sort of superimposed into the center of the piece. And he picked it out, very astutely, I thought, picked it out and did it as a, you know, as a separate song, which I was very happy with because that's why I put it in there.
There will be another song for me, and I will sing. There will be another dream for me, someone will bring it. I will drink the wine while it's warm and never let you catch me looking at the sun. But after all the loves of my life, after all the loves of my life, you'll still be the one. I will take my life into my hands, and I will use it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO. We're talking today with songwriter Jimmy Webb. His new memoir is called The Cake and the Rain. We'll continue our conversation right after this. Jimmy Webb, is it fair to say that the Jimmy Webb in The Cake and the Rain, your new memoir, wants everything he cannot have, and once he has it, he doesn't want it anymore?
I don't think it would be an inaccurate description. There was a kind of frenetic energy working once I had... I think I could describe it this way and say that I think I would have been a happier person if my success had come on a little bit more gradually. But I was just a kid and 19, 20 years old, and all of a sudden it, you know, it's like a clap of thunder. It's like night and day, and I go from making, you know, from not filing an income tax return, because you had to make $600 to file an income tax return. And I had never made $600 since I graduated from high school. And I went from that in 66 to in 67. I remember my accountant, who I shared with Johnny Rivers, telling me one day that I had $60,000. And I had no idea how much $60,000 was. So I set out to find out. And the next year, I probably made $600,000. Within 10 years, I was probably regularly making $1 million a year or more. And so it was such a rush. And the thing is, you know, immediately you're surrounded by a lot of people who know what you should be doing. And events, I've said this before, but I'll say it again, events overtake you. They actually overtake you. There's too much going on. And there may be people near you who have your interest at heart, who are trying to help, but sometimes they're drowned out by other voices who really may not care that much about you and may not understand what you really want to accomplish with your life. Because it becomes like a I can't explain it, like a feeding frenzy. You know, when the money starts rolling in, everybody wants to get a piece of it. And so there's a lot of people around, you know. There's not so many people around these days. But that's okay. I like it the way it is. I really do. And I think that if it had come along a little bit slower and if I'd had to work a little bit harder to get there, I can remember going into my accountant and saying, I want a Rolls Royce. And he said, you can't have a Rolls Royce. I said, what do you mean? I can have anything I want. He says, I'm not going to buy a Rolls Royce for you. And I said, why not? He says, you're too young for a Rolls Royce. Well, so I mauled over that for a while, and I thought, well, I don't quite understand. See, you know, I didn't understand. But he was right. I was too young to be driving a Phantom 5 around town. You know, I mean, that was ridiculous. It's learning on the job, you know. Luckily, I wasn't president of the United States. I was just a songwriter.
You did get a speeding ticket for being stopped at a red light once.
Well, I mean, that one goes down in history. I mean, that has to become part of California mythology, because I'm sitting at a red light in my Cobra 427, my Super Snake that I bought from Carol Shelby personally, and I'm sitting there at a red light at the Havenhurst on-ramp waiting to get on the Ventura Freeway. And a California Highway Patrolman pulls up beside me and stops. And the Cobra decided, of course, that it would be a good time to clear its throat. And it coughed. And it launched a fireball at his motorcycle. And he got off of his bike, parked his bike, and walked over to our car and commanded me to turn the car off. And then I think the ending of the story, which you know, is that there was nothing illegal about that car. It had these big open headers on it, like great big exhausts, chromed exhaust on the outside of the car, like an Indy car. But there was nothing illegal about them, because they were in factory installed. And that was a loophole in the California, you know, hot rod law, was if they were installed at the factory, they were legal. So he couldn't get me. And finally, in frustration, he wrote me a ticket, drove off, and I was sharing it with the devil who was sitting beside me. And I said, look at this. And we just cramped up in an hysterical ball, laughing at this guy because he had written me for excessive display of speed.
While stopped at a red light.
Excessive display of speed with no headway on at all.
Well, you do hint in The Cake and the Rain, Jimmy Webb, that there's going to be another volume. I mean, you didn't call it Volume Chronicles Volume 1, but will there be more memoir from you?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that depends on a lot. There's a lot of factors. I certainly have a lot more story. I mean, I'm just getting into the meat. You know, at the end of that book, I'm just getting into the meat. There are so many people, so many crazy things ahead. You know, and eventually, maybe I'll just give you a little teaser, but eventually I end up living in a castle on top of a hill in New York. And I make this big, you know, move east, and then that's a whole different cast of characters. So I have more than enough for volume two, but it depends on the public. If they like the book, and if it's well received in the community, you know, I could use, you know, a boost from the literary community, from the critics. I would just like for one of them to say, you know, this is an exceptionally well-written book, but, you know, that hasn't really, you know, it hasn't been forthcoming. I haven't been welcomed with open arms by the, you know, the literary insider circle. So we'll just have to see what happens.
Well, now that you've been on From the Bookshelf, both my listeners are going to run out and buy the book.
Well, that would be great if they would, you know, write in and get on my Facebook and write in and tell me what they think of it, good or bad.
It's a fabulous book. It's called The Cake and the Rain, and it's really one of the best music industry memoirs ever written. And
thank you so much.
The author, my guest, Jimmy Webb, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Jimmy Webb. His memoir is called The Cake and the Rain. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.